Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of English and the African American Studies Program. Our speaker is Michelle M. Wright, professor of English at Emory College. Professor Wright's lecture is titled Global Blackness, Representing Polyvalence in the Diaspora. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies Program Director Louis Chude Soki.
Professor Wright is a remarkable scholar, interdisciplinary, cross-cultural, and transnational scholar. One of the few whose deployment of the term blackness I actually trust, not to be myopic. She is the Longstreet Professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. Her first book, Becoming Black, Creating an Identity in the African Diaspora, from 2004, establishes an intellectual genealogy of blackness in West Africa, the Anglophone and Francophone Caribbean, the United States, and Western Europe across the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. Physics of Blackness, Beyond the Middle Passage Epistemology, from 2015, uses theories of time from theoretical physics, philosophy, history, and literature to make theorizations of blackness more accurate and inclusive. Her current project, Feeling Europe, Black and African Diasporas in the Heart of Empire, looks at how space, place, and affect destabilizes and expands notions of home and racial belonging. She's also co-editor of Reading the Black German Experience, a special issue of Callaloo, also of Domain Errors, a cyberfeminist handbook, and Blackness and Sexualities. So please, join me in inviting Michelle M. Wright. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I would like to thank Louis, Professor Chude Soki, and Deirdre James for making all this possible and have all this happen. I want to talk to you today a bit from my book, Physics of Blackness, but specifically with the title that I've already indicated, Global Blackness, Representing Polyvalence in the Diaspora, which really gets at the heart of what I want to talk to you about in terms of understanding blackness as having a whole bunch of different types of valences and meanings, and really sort of pushing against scholarly as well as, well, less so creative, actually, because they tend to be the most open, I find, but scholarly discourses, mass media discourses that quite often, I think, produce a rather two-dimensional notion of blackness. And as you'll see, I really literally mean two-dimensional sometimes. I came to Black Studies in a bit of a weird way. I was doing 19th century French and German literature as a complete undergrad. And I was doing 19th century simply because in high school, after my job, I would go by my weekly novel. And it was either, okay, I can get something like Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea that clocks in at around 200 pages for $5.95. Or for a dollar more, I can get War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, which is 1,400 pages. So it was like more bang for my buck. So I ended up focusing on the 19th century. I guess because also there wasn't a lot of 18th century texts available in Crown books. So it was mostly going to be the 19th century. When I went to Michigan for my PhD, I'd already started getting interested in theory. I was still doing 19th century French and German. And I actually ended up moving more into African diaspora studies because as I got deep into specifically post-structuralist theory, which basically argues that one should be skeptical of any and all categories because there will always be contexts in which a collective identity, the notion of a nation, the notion of a human, the notion of truth, etc., is going to radically change or even contradict earlier definitions. I found that these folks that I was reading, like Derrida and Lacan and Foucault, brilliant guys, but didn't spend a lot of time on blackness, much less gender, frankly. And what I found was some of the responses I was getting, especially as I got interested in theories of subjectivity and asking this question. Now, remember, this is back in like 1992, so this was still an interesting question. I think we're long past it now. Asking things like, okay, if we understand subjectivity, the self-conscious, rational human being, as composed of some kind of tension or relationship between a notion of the self, that which is most definitely I, and a notion of the other, that which I am most definitely not, how do you read yourself as a Black subject when you are more than painfully aware that you are often other? In fact, in theory courses, every once in a while a student would slip up and gesture to the Black students in the room and use the term other, and it's like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Like, it's Okay, whatever. But the responses I got, even from professors I really admired, kind of surprised me, because the response was generally either, oh, just tack yourself on, because they weren't thinking about race at that time. And it's like, well, then that makes no sense, because it's not as if Lacan, Foucault, Derrida say black people can't be subjects and help me get back to business with white people. They don't mention race. So why is it that I'm still excluded? Or they would simply say, you know, it doesn't really matter, because they're speaking neutrally, and you're trying to racialize something that, you know, transcends race. And it's like, well, if it truly transcended race, I wouldn't have this issue of reading myself through it. So that actually became the basis for my first book, because I found professors who told me, that's really interesting, why don't you go ahead and pursue that? You know, get out of my office, you keep coming in. So I just went off to the races. And what I found, of course, was, when you trace back genealogies of subjectivity back to the Enlightenment, what you'll find is, yes, they were actually talking about race. You have Hegel, Kant, and Hume, tutti quanti, all these people talking about black people, talking about Africa, and insisting that they're inferior. And it's striking, because you've got these philosophers from tiny little German towns like Kant, who was famous for never leaving his tiny little gorgeous town, and writing about Africa and writing about Negroes like they knew what was going on. And I have some more to sort of say about that. But even as I began to get interested in theorizing blackness and sort of migrated from African-American studies specifically into African diaspora studies, I was nonetheless finding in textbooks about blackness and black history and textbooks on the black diaspora that they quite often were not engaging with black communities that are very much part of the diaspora. And it was a similar situation. It was a case of, why is it, even though they are not saying only this type of black person really counts as black and we're excluding everybody else, that I was nonetheless finding, truthfully, the vast majority of people from the African diaspora were not showing up, not being considered, not included in textbooks on the black and African diasporas. And that really sort of struck me. It's not as if we don't already have, say, if we look at gender exclusions, sexual exclusions, different cultural and national exclusions, we don't already have articles and books, really amazing ones, that talk about black Europeans, that talk about the contributions of black women and black queers to the African diaspora. So the question gets deeper. Why is it, with all these amazing, compelling arguments, we aren't seeing a change? And if anything, it reminds me a little bit of those high school textbooks you used to get, where the desire to try and include people into the mainstream narrative actually ends up marginalizing them even further, because quite literally, you find them in little colored boxes in the margins. You know, my favorite was the title is often, Did You Know? Did you know that the first black millionaire was Madam C.J. Walker, a black woman? She da 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 da. And then, you know, you remember those little facts and you can't wait to tell your friends at the right moment to impress them. And it's striking, because on one level, the move is an attempt to integrate. But in fact, what you're doing is further underscoring the weirdness that the first black millionaire was a female. Or, and of course, as we know in, like, you know, U.S. history textbooks, did you know that the first person to fall in the Revolutionary War was an African-American man, as y'all know here. So I eventually came to the decision that I wanted to explore this for my second book. Why is it that black collective identity, as it is talked about in the African diaspora, more often than not tends to exclude the vast majority of peoples in the diaspora? And sometimes you find the answers in the strangest places. And for me, it was a 2007 Salon.com article. This is when Salon was still a website you would read. I don't know what's happened to Salon. By a conservative black columnist, actually, Deborah Dickerson, the title is Colorblind, and the lead for it is Barack Obama Ain't Black. And I was like, well, I got to find out why he's not black. So this was just before, of course, he starts to become a serious contender in the Democratic primaries. So she kind of gets the point. She's very good at, like, you know, poking you in the side and irritating you. And so she has all these great ways of angering you. And she finally admits that, okay, by black, I mean middle passage black. And I want to read you this quote from the Dickerson article. Obama isn't black, Black in our political and social reality means those descended from West African slaves. Voluntary immigrants of African descent, even those descended from West Indian slaves, are just that. Voluntary immigrants of African descent with markedly different outlooks on the role of race in their lives and politics. At a minimum, it can't be assumed that a Nigerian cab driver and a third-generation Harlemite have more in common than the fact a cop won't bother to make the distinction. They're both Black as a matter of skin color and DNA, but only the Harlemite, for better or worse, is politically and culturally Black, as we use the term. So incredibly offensive, not particularly accurate in any kind of meaning. I mean, you can take issue with her notion of voluntary immigration. If you are moving to another country because you are a political refugee, is it really voluntary when you know that your family is facing death if you stay, or the means for your own subsistence has been taken away by multinational Western corporations who have your nation in a stranglehold? But in addition to that, what I really want to play with and what really grabbed me was this notion of the Nigerian cab driver and third generation Harlemite. And that was my eureka moment, because what struck me was the fact that this cab driver is called Nigerian, even though chances are high he has U.S. citizenship or some form of green card and is living in the U.S. right now. But nonetheless, she ties him to his supposed ancestral origin. And the third generation Harlemite, the fact that it's mentioned that he's three generations rich with knowledge. Now, on one level, most definitely, you have oral traditions that are passed down and knowledge that is passed down through families. And quite often, as you know, it's more reliable than the stuff that's actually written down and put into bounded volumes. But that doesn't mean that because we are the third generation of something, we are, you know, one generation smarter than our parents, although at the time it often feels that way, two generations smarter than our grandparents, and oh, it just goes on, like our ancestors must have been complete idiots given that we are the 16th generation of what have you. But nonetheless, Dickerson's getting at this notion that really grabbed me of middle passage Blackness. And I'm like, that is so often what we mean when we're talking about Blackness in the diaspora. And the first striking thing about it is, as you notice, she's already pushing West Indian immigrants to the side. Now, West Indian immigrants are quite obviously part of the Middle Passage. And something else that often tends to happen in histories of the Middle Passage is we leave out the vast majority of Black folks whose ancestors came through that Middle Passage. There are roughly 100 million Black Brazilians and maybe 35 million, 38 million Black U.S. Black folks in the U.S., Black citizens, Black denizens. So the question then arises, why is it that we're more focused on a much smaller grouping? And of course, that's not even bringing in all the folks in Central America, all the folks in South America. Now, I'm not interested in actually shoving one group to the side in order to give the other the spotlight, but trying to figure out how can we be completely inclusive so that when we are talking about certain aspects of Blackness that directly involve Black Brazilians, they are front and center rather than having this sort of twisted, distorted notions that don't always serve us. And what I realized was collective identities, especially when they're racially or ethnically based, are historical identities. No duh, right? But it's the way that we imagine that history. And we tend to imagine that history as a linear progress narrative, quite literally a line, a timeline in our textbooks, a timeline in a website, timeline in a documentary. So quite literally two-dimensional. Even when we don't believe in the idea of progress, we don't necessarily believe things are better now than they were 100 years ago, 500 years ago, et cetera, we nonetheless will have this sense that progress should have happened and that certain people have been denied that progress. In other words, we have this sense that time moves forward on a line. And as it moves forward, things get better, or that is supposed to at least be the natural dynamic. Now, on one level, this notion of Middle Passage Blackness as a linear timeline does a lot of good. And I have to admit, when I was first thinking about this and thinking about time and the way we draw it as a line and, you know, what in the world have we ever experienced where time seems to move forward for us? Are we 24 hours smarter than we were the year before? Are 80-year-olds the most successful people on the planet because they've got 80 years on newborns? And nonetheless, we do play with some of that, right? Like when we're looking at Black studies or frankly, almost any discipline that's looking at racial and ethnic populations, gender populations, we tend to pay more attention to adults. So we even tend to map adults on this progress narrative as if children aren't quite finished yet. So there's no point in really looking at them. Or if we look at them, it's important to kind of keep them as their own separate group. But there are other aspects to this that are really interesting. On one level, I love the way Middle Passage Blackness, as this linear progress narrative, so successfully subverts and upsets the apple cart. You can see it in like PBS documentaries when they're talking about the founding of the nation. And, you know, you can already picture the playing of the fife, you know, all Mary and stuff as it, you know, does the sort of close-up shots on Washington and Jefferson and Adams. And if it's a responsible documentary, then you get the bon, 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 and then you get the sepia photographs of slaves. And it doesn't know how to integrate the two. You go from the fife to bon, 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 and then, okay, let's get back to the main story. So what that does is it upsets that apple cart, but at the same time, there doesn't seem to be any way to integrate it. And that's because lines are so incredibly restrictive. They're two-dimensional. A linear progress narrative, to begin with, always has to start with an origin. And as we know, we play with origins. Origins cut things off. Origins relegate certain things to the past when you're talking about a timeline where you're moving through space. So, for example, if our origin is in slavery and we at least gesture to African belonging, Africa gets trapped in the past on that timeline. They don't get to move forward as we move forward into the Americas. And we also have this in African American history, this notion that the South is the past because we see African Americans moving north. So we end up with this notion that certain geographical spaces are backward. And it's interesting because we know it's not true, and yet at the same time, we tend to identify contemporary Blackness in the U.S. with the North, especially the Northeast and the West Coast, and we're not quite sure what to make of the quote-unquote reverse migration now happening, where so many Black folks are moving back to the South. I'm one of them. That's why it's important to me. I don't care about anybody else. The other thing that happens with origins as they cut things off is there's a kind of interesting paradox with a linear progress narrative, because whatever you decide your origin is, all the other events that follow must be linked to that origin. If you're doing a history of medicine, you can't suddenly put in that bubblegum was invented. It doesn't fit on your timeline. But that means you have a limited notion of progress already. In other words, if every event must correspond back to that origin, you can never really get away from that origin completely. So the progress narrative always requires a constant return to origin. Most strikingly for me, though, and it seemed to really sort of answer one of these big questions about inclusion and why we don't see different groups being represented at certain moments, you only get one dot to represent that collective on the timeline, which means that when you hit something like the amendment where African American men are granted the right to vote, kind of, in letter, if not in actual practice, you have to pause for a moment because you're like, okay, African American women have not been granted the right to vote here. Do I put it on my progress timeline? We almost always decide, yeah, we should put it because it's such a significant event. But whether we mean to or not, immediately there's a suggestion that Black men are more authentically Black than Black women because they occupy that dot. And if you go through enough events on the timeline, it really doesn't matter who you are, heterosexual Black male, sooner or later you will find not all events correspond to you. So in a weird way, that collective dot ends up representing no one when you take all these events together. But for me, most strikingly, in terms of, because I tend to have this sort of, you know, philosophical bent towards things, unlike, say, what we call the 1776 timeline, or I tend to call historical timelines, in this case, epistemologies, because they're narratives of knowledge. A dictionary is an epistemology, an encyclopedia is an epistemology. Sometimes in philosophy, they don't like that notion that everything's an epistemology, but as a post-structuralist, we tend to argue all forms of knowledge are manipulated forms of knowledge because you can't include everything into anything. So that means you are automatically shaping this form of knowledge. It's not objective. So when you look at something like what I'd call the 1776 epistemology, that, because we're all around the Boston Brahmins, who can say, my parents came here and they overcame these obstacles and they worked hard and they fought and da-da-da-da-da. African Americans do not get to enter this epistemology, nor does any black group in the diaspora, as an agent of history. For the 1776 epistemology, absolutely. It's about my great-great-grandparents made the choice to come here. They were seeking freedom. But what do you do if your origin starts with other people deciding what is going to happen to you? And then if you look at African American history, whether you're looking at slavery, the Emancipation Proclamation, the Civil War, civil rights, Jim Crow before that, excuse me, black power, maybe we're going to put Obama on the timeline, maybe not. Every single event is either a reaction to whiteness or an overcoming of whiteness. So the real agents on our timeline, and this is the moments where it doesn't totally work, other times it does work, the real agents on our timeline are white, which means blackness simply becomes a reaction to whiteness. And of course, what's striking about this is the fact that we know it's not true. If all black people were was a reaction to whiteness, we wouldn't have black culture, we wouldn't have black music, we wouldn't have black politics, we wouldn't possess an identity that in many ways, almost the entire world population gets obsessed with from time to time and gloms onto, and we see artists who work it so well. So obviously there's got to be more valences. Blackness cannot simply be two-dimensional. Oh, and as a fun side note, even according to Dickerson's definition, Barack Obama probably is black because Barack Obama's mother is descended from the Punch family, who it looks like passed for white after a couple generations. So in other words, we also have this problem with Middle Passage timelines because trying to map a history of a collective is like trying to herd cats. They just wander out in all sorts of different ways. So sometimes what you find is a Middle Passage history isn't going straight through the family tree, it's coming through different branches and arriving in a different way. And it's another reminder of we can't think about time as moving forward. Genealogists have a bit of a joke that if you hire a genealogist and he tells you that you are the 32nd descendant of Genghis Khan, what's more interesting actually is if you're not the 32nd descendant of Genghis Khan. And that is because family trees, we prune the crap out of them, excuse my language. Family trees actually tend to go more horizontally than vertically. And before you know it, by the time you've hit the 32nd generation, yeah, all of us in this room are probably descendants of Genghis Khan. It's fun, isn't it? Let's all go tell people that. That's what I learned today, hence my violent nature. So where does this idea of time moving forward come from? And why do we use this linear timeline? On one level, we know because it's a gorgeous way to teach so much information. Just put a timeline on the blackboard and students can immediately figure out what you're talking about and where you're placing things, and a lot of complex information can be moved and communicated. But there are times when it doesn't work. It's kind of like driving. As my very nervous friend told me as she lent me her car and I was learning how to drive on it. I can't simply drive in the moment. Because by the time I've adjusted for the moment, I'm already past that moment. So in other words, you always have to have a sort of imaginary line that you're moving toward in front of you. And so what I realize is even though this notion of linear time is what we call idealist, which doesn't mean it has lofty ideals, it just simply means it's based in ideas, not in a lived reality, we kind of need it to get through life at certain moments. We need to have a sense of moving forward. We need to have a sense of progress. We need to use it in order to complain about the abrogation of rights of so many citizens, especially under Donald Trump. So this is where the physics come in. Physics, excuse me. Our notion of linear time corresponds really heavily with Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion and gravity. And I don't know if you were like me in that physics class where you're learning the laws of motion and gravity and kind of wondering why Newton was considered a genius. Because I'm like, I know when I throw a rock at that person's head that I'm taking an inert object and I'm putting it in motion and I'm aiming it at their head because the rock is going to stop at their head. So an object in motion stays in motion until it encounters a rock-hard object that is not in motion. But what Newton was actually able to do with these laws about objects and when they move and why they move was to plug and play them into mathematical equations. Newton and Leibniz, as you probably know, are the inventors of calculus. And calculus supposedly is able to tell you why that rock is there at the bottom of the river, where it was 100 years ago, where it's going to be 1,000 years from now. But what's striking here is two things. One, it may help explain those Enlightenment philosophers I mentioned to you. For example, when Hegel says, so we see Africa now, such as it has always been, and so it will always be. This were a man who never traveled to Africa. Suddenly he's, because he believes, it seems, that these equations can be plug and played into the universe. There's a problem with this, though. In theoretical particle physics means subatomic particles, Newtonian physics simply does not work. We don't see objects in motion going on until they encounter another object that's at a different velocity or not in velocity, et cetera, et cetera. Newtonian physics only works in a vacuum. You can tell me where that rock was so long as we cancel out the possibility that a pachyderm knocked that rock. It came ambling along 50 years ago and knocked it to the bottom of the river. So this notion of time moving forward and progress, I realized, also only happens in a vacuum. Whenever we want to say that something has progressed, African Americans have progressed over the past 200 years, what we are automatically doing, willingly or not, is cutting out those who have not progressed. Because there are some you can look at and you can argue the best way to understand their situation is to understand it through slavery. Because we see them being treated in the same way. We see them being cheated out of their labor. We see them being incarcerated on the same flimsy reasons. It doesn't make sense unless we trace it back. So in other words, change, as the old saying goes, is the only constant, and progress only happens in a vacuum. Now, it's striking because even though in particle physics they've decided, yeah, we're not even sure if time exists, we're not sure even if, we definitely don't think time moves forward, even as they talk about these other theories of time, they will lament quite often in the first 50 pages of the book about how physics has not progressed in the past 70 years, and, oh, we need to get back on track, etc. So it shows for even those folks who have disproven the notion that time moves forward, there's still this notion that something is awry because we haven't progressed far enough. If you get a physicist into a corner, pick someone who looks kind of weak, and threaten them and demand that they tell you what time is, they may demur at first, but sooner or later they'll say, if time is anything, if it actually exists, because they think maybe the growing of a plant, the ticking of a clock, the spinning of the earth may actually all be separate types of dynamics that we've just all grouped under this rubric of time because we can't see the infinitesimal differences between them at the molecular level or the subatomic level. They say, if time is anything, time is entropy. Time is the movement of molecules from a tightly bound, rigid order to a looser and more chaotic order. So time is ice melting. Time is human beings and trees growing. Time is quite possibly the Big Bang. So time doesn't move forward. Time moves outward if it exists. And there's a couple more fun things that come into this. As I was reading these lay books on physics about time, because I had gone through sort of philosophy, and I was finding that the discussions on philosophy either talked about linear time, circular time, or spiral time. And all three notions, at certain moments they are different from one another, but they're all based on the same principles, that time is tripartite. It's made up of a past, which creates the present, which creates the future. Or, you know, sometimes people get fancy, like the, you know, the future creates the past, which, you know, then creates a cow, and that creates the present, that kind of thing. So it's tripartite, and it tends to be directly causal, whether it's spiral or circular or linear. But In this physics book, well, there were several, and I knew something important was going on because I didn't understand it at first. They were using a lot of exclamation points, which, you know, showed my genius brain that something important was happening here. It's called Wheeler's 1980 Witch Path Experiment. And it has something to do with, you know, spewing subatomic particles through a splitter beam and then tracking the wave patterns. And I can't even get into all of it. So I'm going to give you a really simple analogy when I finally figured it out. Say you're a sadistic deity and you've got a castle. And the castle has two rooms. It's got a central chamber and an antechamber. Because you're sadistic, you've got two monsters that you flip in and out of the central chamber, only one at a time, Darth Vader or a dragon. In the antechamber, you put two weapons at all times, lightsaber or sword. And y'all know how this goes. Only the sword can kill the dragon. Only the lightsaber can kill Darth Vader. Every time they run that experiment, the particle chooses the correct weapon. Now, if we use this notion of tripartite causal time, and some people have applied it to Wheeler's, the argument is subatomic particles can see into the future. But there's another possibility, and it was one I was playing with. It's the idea that let's play with an idea of time as we experience it, which is simply this moment. So the particle's not seeing into the future. The particle is simply picking up the correct weapon because of what's in the antechamber. And the particle outside the castle, the particle in the antechamber, the particle in the central chamber are all of the same moment. Because when we think about it quite materialistically, the past is not behind us somewhere in some separate space that we can travel to with a DeLorean. The past is all around us in changed form. All the people that lived before, some of the buildings are still here, the clothing, the texts, the food, the animals, they are still all around us, simply in changed form. You may have eaten your grandmother for lunch today, you don't know, or part of her. The present is an ideal construct, because if I try to explain to you the present moment by saying it's me talking to you right now, but not right now when I just said right now, I mean right now, because before that was the past, and what I really want to talk to you about is the present. Oh, but by the time you get these words to your ears, it's already in the past. And that's simply because we are always constantly in motion, which means the future isn't something set in front of us. It is also part of this moment. Movement is our hearts beating. It is the earth circulating. There is no stillness. There is constant motion. Now, you can play, just as a side note, with Julian Barber, who is a particle physicist that has argued time doesn't exist because movement is something that our brains put together. It takes very quick, still pictures of what's going on around us, and the neurons connect it into motion. So his argument is time is motion, and if there is no motion, then time doesn't exist. But I want to play with this notion of epiphenomenal time because it helps me get to this question of polyvalence and how we can accurately represent blackness. So in this moment, the past is all around us in changed form, and the present and the future are simply one. They can't be separated out from one another. And I'd simply call it epiphenomenal time. It's simply the moment of the now. It's not a radically new idea. You will find it in different discourses. Of course, the moment I worked all this out, I start coming across it everywhere else. And it's always versions of what I'm arguing. So I'm still kind of like, okay, phew, maybe I'm not robbing people who come in to buy Physics of Blackness and take a chance on it. Because they're like, it's 200 pages and it clocks in at 1995. That's kind of expensive. Maybe I'll get War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy instead. But I want to give you a couple of case studies where I think it can work. Olauda Equiano. We often teach Equiano in African diaspora courses because the interesting narrative of his life, the autobiography written by him, so gorgeously parallels Middle Passage Blackness. It begins in Western Africa with him as a free African. He's then enslaved. His is the only narrative we have of a first-person account of the slave ship crossing through the Atlantic Ocean, sold into slavery in the United States, eventually wins his freedom after being tricked a couple times by slave owners who said, yeah, I'll lend you out to do other labor when you're done working with me, and then if you save up enough money, I'll free you. I think it happened twice, and both times they reneged on the deal, because of course with slavery, if you are a white slave owner, you don't have to honor anything that a slave, you know, tries to do with you in striking a deal. eventually escapes to Britain, becomes an abolitionist working out of London and Sierra Leone. So it's a beautiful, beautiful story that's a great way to teach Middle Passage blackness. One problem, about 15 years ago, the leading Equiano scholar, Vincent Coretta, discovered two pieces of unwelcome news. One, a record of births in a South Carolina parish where an Olauda Equiano is recorded as being born and roughly fits the same date as our Equiano. And a ship's manifest disembarking in England that also has, and this corresponds to Equiano's own voyage to England, an Olauda Equiano on board who notes in the manifest that his birthplace is South Carolina. So what do we do with this? On one hand, Coretta has said, given the fact that Equiano was trying to win his freedom, he may in fact have simply lied about being born in South Carolina. And Olauda Equiano, there may have been another one born in South Carolina. So it's possible the whole narrative is true. But until, if ever, there's more historical information, we don't know. So what do we do? Do we teach Equiano or do we not? Can we put him on our timeline or is he off the timeline? With epiphenomenal time, with the now, I picture it very much like a dot with several lines radiating out of it. We don't have to worry about this two-dimensionality, is Equiano on or off the timeline? Instead, in teaching it, we can tell the story about Coretta and talk about how we have an embarrassment of Equianos. There's actually a lot of possibilities. He could have been born in West Africa and he could have been born in South Carolina. And it makes sense to talk about both things, why it's possible to have blackness in both those cases. He could have actually written an accurate narrative of being enslaved on a slave ship. He could have made it up. And it's worth talking about the transmission of knowledge and identity and why that is possible. The rest we're all pretty sure of. He was definitely in London, definitely in Sierra Leone. But with epiphenomenal time, you suddenly get to stop on your timeline when you're not sure whether somebody's on or off it, and instead move outward to talk about different polyvalences of blackness. I will give a couple more examples and then draw to a close. Black Germans, which is a group that I work with because they really cannot be mapped onto a timeline. And that's simply because you can trace Black German history back to at least the 16th century of what eventually became Germany. As you know, Germany did not become a unified nation until 1871. But we're always talking about different histories of Black Germans. Sometimes, as in the 17th century, you're talking about relatively wealthy West Africans who were studying at German universities to get a degree in business, law, or medicine. If you scoot up to the end of World War I, you have Black Germans that are the result of liaisons between the Tirailleurs Sénégalais, Senegalese fusiliers, although they were not just from Senegal, and white German women. If you scoot up to after World War II, you're looking at the offspring of African-American servicemen and white German women. If you scoot up to 10 years ago, you're looking at contemporary West African, North African, and East African immigrants. So you don't even get your dot on the timeline. And I was actually just asked to review recently a really sharp, well-researched historical anthology about the history of Black Germans. And what they had chosen to do was to choose a white German timeline. Why not, right? We're talking about Black Germans and we can clearly, you know, match them up to certain dates. But as you read it, you get this sense of, and I know how important Black Germans are, that they're almost a weird side story, right? Because when you get to like 1871 and the unification of Germany, it's kind of not in the history. It's like, it's a bit weird. And when you get to 1933, when Hitler becomes chancellor, it's really more about what Black Germans are doing, which is interesting, but there's still that sense of Hitler's becoming chancellor, y'all. Like, let's pay greater attention. And I started to think about this. Why is it with that timeline, suddenly Black Germans seem marginal? But if we start in this moment, we can talk about how Black Germans intersect with so many key parts of European and US history. We can talk about immigration. We can talk about African civilizations. We can talk about the role African-American servicemen played in both wars. We can go on and on and on. We can talk about stunningly frightening situations where, because a lot of times with these African-American servicemen, once their white officer found out that they were having an affair, they were shipped back, especially if they thought the soldier wanted to marry the woman. They didn't want that. White soldiers were allowed to marry white German women. Black soldiers were not allowed to marry them. So the father's sent away, and This little black girl is growing up quite often in an all-white German town with her white mother, and the mother gets remarried. And it didn't happen a lot of the time, but it happened enough where the stepfather was a former member of the SS. So talk about nightmare scenario. Your new stepdad is part of Hitler's former SS. So they were sent off to orphanages. But that story in itself shows us intersections where blackness is, where normally you think it shouldn't be, black people under Hitler, which epiphenomenal time can get to and center and talk about. Final example, Cassandra Pybus wrote this fascinating history called Black Founders. And it's basically about how she stumbled across some historical texts in Australia. She's a white Australian historian that showed that some of the first settlers to come off the convict ships in Australia were not just English and Irish and Scottish and Welsh, but African American and possibly Black Caribbean. And so she traced the history of these Black convicts. Long story short, a lot of them were the African Americans who helped, who allied with the British during the Revolutionary War in return for their own freedom, which is something that Washington was unwilling to grant African Americans who wanted to help the revolutionary cause. The British kept their word in taking them to England with them. But of course, what's going on in England at this time over the past 200 years is the dispossession of farmers from their land as the nobility moves in and takes over these enormous farms. And suddenly, these former farmers have a choice. You can leave, or you can tend this tiny little plot of land and work for me. So you have the migration of people into major cities. You have African Americans who were promised jobs and not given jobs also in cities. They're rubbing shoulders with the ultra wealthy in places like London and Manchester, and they're stealing in order to survive. So the British courts decide, well, now that we no longer have the United States as a penal colony, let's ship them to Australia with this place that we quote unquote discovered a few years ago, couldn't figure out what to use it for. So they come over, and Pybus tracks their various lives and what they got up to. But at the end of the day, she says, you know, they either married into different Aboriginal nations or they married into the white population. So it's not like you have a community today that we can track. So I'm not sure what to do with this history beyond sort of noting that it happened. So it's almost like a huge fun fact. This entire book, did you know that some of the first settlers in Australia were Black, African American, Black Caribbean? With epiphenomenal time, though, you can talk about how they intersect with indigeneity, how they intersect with settlers, how they intersect with certain parts of British history, and how they connect U.S. and British history in ways that you can't necessarily follow through white colonists, because it was Black folks who had this particular experience. So in other words, and I'll finish with this, most importantly, I feel that what epiphenomenal time gives us is this sense of agency. You read yourself in the moment and make the links that you need to make, rather than understanding yourself as a product of history who was booted along in various moments to different events along a linear timeline. And instead, you read yourself in this moment and figure out what you intersect with. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for a fascinating talk. What's your thought on reading yourself into the moment in the realm of people telling you that what you read is incorrect? And aren't we often trapped by and criticized because if we read ourselves a certain way, then we're considered either traitorous or invalid?
Yes, absolutely. This is a great question. And this is where I come to the realpolitik of epiphenomenal time and agency. What I realized was one thing we already know, which is identity is not a fixed static thing. Identity is what you do. It is what you perform. Even though, of course, strikingly, we often talk about it as what you are. And we know that identity is that fragile because even in a campus setting, if you have a student that you've decided looks black, but they proclaim themselves as white, there's going to be a lot of disciplining going on. Rachel Dolezal can attest to being read one way and insisting that she's another. So, but the thing I want to get at is, we all have the freedom of choice to choose what we want to be, barring extreme situations. What we don't have is the right to make other people see what we are. So, and to add this to this and make it even more complicated, I argue that we do have choice, but choice is not this gorgeous thing that the Enlightenment philosoph claimed it was. They make it sound as if when you're making a choice, you stand back with an infinite amount of time and you can look at all the possible permutations and choices with all the knowledge that you need and then make the right choice when you need to make it. That's not usually how it happens. If we read ourselves in different moments, we're going to read ourselves in different identities. And we often are going to make choices that are between a rock and a hard place. Quite often what's difficult about a choice is it benefits one part of our identity and harms another part, and we have to go in between. And a lot of times, as we know, we don't make great choices. We don't have all the information we need. We don't have all the time we need. And all I really want to get at with that notion of choice is the fact that it starts here. We may react to what somebody is saying or doing to us and decided they started it, they made me think of this. But you could have two people standing side by side. I could have another Black lesbian academic right next to me, and we react very differently to what somebody has said. And this has actually happened to me, going by a white homeless guy, and he uses the N-word. And my friend was really shook up. And I was a total arrogant bourgeois. I'm like, that poor man doesn't even know where his next meal is coming from. I mean, it was just really, I know where my next meal is coming from, you know, and striding on by. I wasn't scared. I looked down on him, and not in a good way. She was just shook up and couldn't, you know, it took a couple days to kind of get over it. She felt threatened. And what hit me was choice is also not something we necessarily feel like we have total control of. I didn't plan my reaction. My reaction was simply what came out of me. But the fact that it was different showed different choices were made. And I almost want to suggest it may even be knee-jerk. It may be just deep in ontology and not epistemology. It may be more about being, although I'm not really sure what being is. But as we know, we all have to do that, right? We all have to negotiate our choices. Final example I want to give. I was asked to give a couple of workshops on diversity at this small liberal arts college. And there were two straight white male colleagues who really wanted to talk to me. Just lovely people. They both had the same pressing question. Why can't I use the N-word in my literature classes? That's what they wanted to know, out of all the different questions. And my response was, you can. There's nothing stopping you. What you're asking is the right to control the reaction to your use of that term. And they didn't want to hear that. They kept going on about, why don't I have the right? But that is so often what free speech is about, too. You have the freedom to say it, but you can't control how people are going to react to it. And you don't have the right to control how people feel. Now, both told a hilarious story, just as a postscript, of white male football players taking them aside at the end of the class and being like, man, you can't say that. That's just completely wrong. And I just love the fact that these football players who probably have Black colleagues on the team that they're thinking about were the ones who kind of came up and pointed this out. So that's sort of my response to that notion about choice.
Thank you for this great talk. This was really fascinating. And my question is, from the framework of how to teach this sort of mindset, with your example about Aquinas, I was thinking about, I was a teaching assistant for a class where we read Lehmann's Long Division, and the students wanting definitive answers about, is a character time traveling or the same character, and me sort of trying to say, like, well, why does it matter that you need to know yes or no? And so my question is, how do we teach this framework of time in a system that is, that where we're taught very clearly to have yes and no answers and to fit this system. So,
well, okay.
Yes, the linear context.
I still arrange my syllabi in linear order because I have this sense that quite often formations of knowledge that count for students and that they're graded and evaluated on come in chronological form. So I'm not going to deny that to them. So I give it to them quite clearly, but then of course I feel free to mess with it at various points. When you will have some students who hate this and some students who love it, but for me, it's always when I teach, the rare times I've actually taught A Passage to India by E.M. Forster, where something happened in the Malabar Caves. What happened? We don't know. Did Dr. Aziz actually rape Miss Quested, or did she simply have, you know, a fainting crazy white woman fit? We don't know. You're told you're not supposed to ask the question. That's not the point. But what I found is I asked the question. I wanted, like, he set it up. He wants us to ask that question. So instead, it's just a plus-plus situation. Rather than the either or don't ask that question, it's like, let's play through all the different threads and why we want to ask them. And let's get into who believes what happened. So students can get this sense that there are so many different ways to perceive a certain moment. And quite often I find getting into that kind of discussion where they're allowed to just go deeper and not even have to come down hard on one side or hard on another leads to all sorts of, as you know, amazing discussions about rape, violence, colonization, historical actors acting under certain forms of oppression, the ways in which Dr. Azeez is and is not a subordinate figure to Ms. Quested, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm intrigued by your when and where and what. Do you think that this dynamic spreads to other identity areas as well?
Yes, it does. I think it does. And you know something? I got into Black studies not necessarily because I think Black people are the most fascinating people on earth, although we are, but because it's so gorgeously global. And it's not the only way, but it's one of the best ways to learn about the world, to learn about complexities of the world. So I really sort of felt like by figuring this out with Blackness, which is one of the, to me, the toughest categories, so it's because it's so polyvalent, so complex, you know, has these historical questions that really get you into deep philosophy, that if I could figure out for Blackness, then chances are I could find a model that ideally, probably with some adjustment, could be applied to other groups. I would argue that for the vast majority of racial and ethnic groups, including indigenous peoples, we place them all on a linear timeline and we interpolate them that way. The way, for example, we tend to read indigenous peoples as static, you know, and then we fetishize that. Like the way they do things is how they did it 1,000 years ago. Probably not, because human beings are dynamic actors. But it's also even true for stuff that, like, it seems kind of crazy, but you have to ask about, like, women. When and where are you describing the female, and how are you constructing it? When and where is the peasant? I think it's probably true for the vast majority of collective identity. When and where is the queer? Because that's another identity that, like Blackness, was constructed and invented by people who didn't identify as being part of that in-group. So...
listen, please, thank Michelle Wright for speaking to us tonight. This is really wonderful.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Michelle M. Wright, professor of English at Emory College. Professor Wright's lecture was titled Global Blackness, Representing Polyvalence in the Diaspora, and was presented by the Boston University Department of English and the African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director Louis Chude Soki. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepihars. Thanks for joining us.